I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Unapologetically Black Podcast.
Understanding that your blackness is part of your greatness.
Blackness just comes from being me, and that's it.
Men are allowed to do whatever the fuck they want to do. They can be cheaters, they can be liars, but women are expected to be righteous.
So if you're someone who in a concert you're going to say the N-word, in my opinion, at home you're going to say it as well. In friendship, there's someone who deposits and there's someone who withdraws. You don't want to be the friend that's keep depositing and the person that keeps withdrawing.
Poor people don't have time for depression.
I'm so tired.
Abortions doesn't actually reduce abortion.
But actually, if my mental health is not okay, I can't help you in any capacity.
I mean, my entire life I've lived under the gaze of my parents.
Fuck that shit.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Unapologetically Black podcast. And today we have a guest with us, which is very exciting. It's not usual for us to have a guest join us today. So welcome, Jamisha.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Hi.
In usual fashion, I have a rant. I have something I'd like to talk about. Today is not bad vibes though, so it's okay. We're doing good vibes over here. We're wearing pink. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you guys, when it comes to romantic relationships, yeah, what do you think holds more weight? Love or safety? If you had to choose one, love or safety?
I feel like they're intertwined. Like, I feel like if I love you, I should feel safe with you. But maybe not the other way around. Like, just because I feel safe with you doesn't mean that I love you romantically. So I would say love because it's built into the other.
I think I would agree. I think I was going to say the same thing. Like, my definition of love is more about, it's more of an active word. It's more about, like, you know, your behaviors, what you do and type of stuff, not necessarily just acts of service, but it's very intentional. So I would have usually put safety built into the word. So I think I'd probably have the same answer as well.
Mm-hmm. I was eavesdropping, you know, as you do on public transport, and I heard some people discussing this topic, and I was thinking to myself, like, what do I think? And I was like, obviously love. And then I'm like, well, how can I love a person that doesn't make me feel safe? So I'm like, obviously safety. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, how can I be with someone for the rest of my life that I don't love? And then one of the people in the group were like, what you guys just said, basically, that they don't see it as two individual things when it comes to romantic relationships, and that ultimately you have to have them both, but they can't see it as individuals. So I just wanted to get your viewpoint on that. But yeah, so as Leanne said at the start of the podcast, this week in a special episode, we are joined by Jamisha, or who I frequently call Jam, who is the founder and the creator behind the page You Look Okay To Me. And Jamisha is someone I've known since college. Wow, getting on. Ooh, sorry, I was about to work out the maths and I don't need to do that. Yeah.
I was like, please don't.
So Jamisha is someone I've known since college. And she was always a very creative babe. She was always, you know, the one that I would always, genuinely actually, I never told you this, but when it came to all the course that we was doing, I feel like I secretly struggled a lot, and you always seemed to just know what you was doing and you were just in your bag creatively when it came to like videos and stuff like that, which just wasn't for me at all. Leanne knows I absolutely hate videos. So it's interesting to now see you kind of combine your love for like videos and content creating for the cause that's really important, and like giving a voice and showcasing representation of people who are Black and disabled or have chronic illnesses. I don't remember in college being aware that you had any sort of condition. And maybe it's just none of my business, so I just didn't know. You know, I don't have to have known for it to exist. But I just wonder if you knew at that point.
So I knew something. I kind of started getting sick on the second year we were in college. So I knew there was something going on, but I wasn't diagnosed yet. I got diagnosed just before I started uni. So yeah, it's lupus. I have a few other conditions, but the main one that sort of sparks everything is a condition called lupus, or the long name is systemic lupus erythematosus. Makes me sound smart when I say the full name. It sounds like I've like done something, but it's an autoimmune disease. So, you know, the short of it is your immune system is meant to protect you from infection, and autoimmune diseases means that it attacks the healthy parts of your body by mistake. It's a kind of some kind of malfunction in the immune system. So I get like joint pain, fatigue, loads of other symptoms. And yeah, like on the second year of Brit school, I could feel something, like I was getting shortness of breath. Like I was really fit at Brit school. I used to work out all the time. And then I just started not being able to get out of bed. I was actually sometimes late to school. So it's so funny that you say like, oh, I didn't struggle, or that's how it perceived. It means I don't know what I was projecting, because there were some hidden struggles, but I guess everyone wears it differently. Yeah. You know, you never know. And so, yeah, I knew there was something wrong, but I wasn't sure exactly what it was. So during that time at the second year of Brit school, I was going to hospital a lot, trying to figure out what it was. And then, yeah, just as I started uni, that's when I actually got the official diagnosis that it was a disease called lupus.
Is lupus a condition that is typical for it to be diagnosed late? Because I have a friend who also found out maybe like 3 years ago. So I'm wondering if there's an overlap here in both of your experiences.
Firstly, it depends on how severe your lupus is affecting you and how obvious it presents, because there's like a stereotypical presentation of it, which is harder for it to not be diagnosed. So if you have this butterfly rash and it appears across your cheeks and it spreads across, usually you'll get diagnosed very quickly. As you can see, I have dark skin. I don't know if your friend does too. And the majority of people that have lupus are black and brown people, black and Asian people. That rash doesn't show up as obvious, especially if you have mild lupus. So when that doesn't happen, it's a little harder to get diagnosed. And just secondly, I think why some people get it a little later, it's just the medical system's not set up for adequate diagnosis in time. You often get gaslit, you get told it's all in your head, and it's very common for that to happen to a lot of people. So it usually means it happens quite late. And then lastly, lupus can just look like loads of different things. Sometimes they'll just go, oh, it's arthritis. And if you're a little older, they'll say, oh, it's just old age, or oh, you're growing, it's hormones, it's da-da-da. It gets piled off as loads of things until it gets quite obvious if it progresses. So it's a mix. It does depend. I do know some people where they got diagnosed when they were kids because it was just very apparent that they had something. So yeah, it depends. Average time though, they say, is about 8 years. Like if you, and from the start when you feel like something's wrong, they say it's like 8 years it takes to get official
8 years diagnosis. To get diagnosed,
more or less, from when you first feel something's off until then. And for me, it's a little less than that, but it was a few years overall.
It's interesting because I also know a few people who have lupus, more specifically two sisters and a couple of people I went to high school with. And I feel like growing up in a Black community, it feels like a lot of people, I just assume that it was a wide disease. But actually, you're right. Black and brown people are, I think, three times more likely, is that it, than white people to get it?
I think it's like that. I don't know the stat specifically, but that sounds about right.
And is that due to, I don't know if you know, if it's due to like late diagnosis, as you mentioned, or is there something that, because it's an autoimmune disease, right? So it's not something that environment necessarily contributes to.
They don't know, so they're not sure. They think, from what I've seen in terms of recent research, is that it's a mix. It's some genetic predisposition and a mix of environmental factors, but they don't know for sure. Some research is saying that it starts in the gut, like it's hard to tell. Mm. I have a feeling it's a mix of like genetic and environment. So for example, I have a few family members that have passed from lupus, so there's clearly some kind of thing in the family. And I personally think, I have no proof of this, that it was, I guess, triggered, because I reckon it's like the genes are there, and in the right circumstance, the disease can like come to life. And I got a really bad flu around Brit school, which I've heard this story quite commonly with people with lupus, that you'll get like a flu, or what they might perceive now to be an Epstein-Barr virus, because it's hard to tell. And then that's when I noticed it kind of go downhill. So there's no proof of that, but they kind of think it's a bit of, genetic predisposition. And also if you catch a virus, sometimes it can really make your immune system go off somewhere. But I don't know exactly why it affects Black people and Asian people more. I don't know. It's not like sickle cell where there's a bit more of a specific to it, like, because they say it's like a genetic mutation that is for malaria, and that's sort of where it came from. So if you're from a country that more likely has malaria, you're more likely to have sickle cell or thalassemia or something. Well, for lupus, I don't know. So would be nice to know.
Talk us through your process of being diagnosed, because obviously you was quite young at that time. So was that something that was quite scary for you to find out? Did you have much knowledge about lupus already because of your family members? Like, what was the actual journey like to getting a diagnosis? How easy was it for you?
It was very difficult. The diagnosis process was not nice. I wouldn't say it was scary. It was more frustrating. There were times where it was a little scary. But overall, it was annoying. I was just getting angry because I knew there was something off and everyone was saying, oh, it's fine. All the doctors were like, oh, just take vitamins. But like, I kind of could feel something was off. Probably around, like Brit school. So I, you know, was like, okay, I want to be fit. I was doing, you know, that workout DVD, Insanity, you know, that one at home where you got to be doing, I was doing that. I was like, I'm going to get a six pack. Like, I'm going to be sick. And then all of a sudden, like, I was really in good peak sort of physical. I felt great. And then I just went to sleep and couldn't wake up. Like, I was sleeping for like 18 hours in the day. And then my joints would hurt, like it just felt terrible. And so I was just kind of like, there's something going on. So constantly going back to the GP, they'd go, oh, it's a vitamin D deficiency. So then I take the vitamin D. I'm like, okay, I still don't feel better. Oh, I think you need to take vitamins, take Barocca. I'm like, all right, fair enough. Like, and it just kept going back and they just weren't taking it seriously. So I just started going on my Googles. And everyone says not to do that.
Because Google, it always gives you an extreme option. Like, you'll Google, I have a headache. It'll be like, you're dying, you're going to die tomorrow. And it's like...
Exactly. And obviously, like, I always say, do an intelligent Google. Don't think, obviously, immediately, I'm dying. But, like, I made a list of 5 things that it sounded like. And then I brought it to the GP. And then I found out what you would need to test. Because what they do is, like, you'll get, like, a basic blood test. And they'll go, blood came back clear. But you're not actually testing for lupus or arthritis.
Right.
You're testing for kidney function and all these basic ones. So I had to go in and be like, I want the anti-ANA and the anti-SSB. I had to name all of... I had to be like, I know what I'm talking about. And then they're like, oh, I'm going to refer you. And so I started getting referred. And then I got told that it was in my head. Really? I had one doctor that was like, sounds like lupus. And then another doctor came and said, actually... I don't think so. I think you have a mental health problem. I'm going to prescribe you antidepressants and you need to see a psychotherapist because you're stressed. And I started crying, like, because when she was saying that, I was like, what is this woman talking about? And then she said, see, you're crying, you're stressed. I'm like, okay. Okay, so me and my mum, because my mum came with me, we left and made a complaint. And then because of that complaint, she immediately referred us to the specialist clinic, which is in Guy's Hospital. And I walked in the office and the man was like, yeah, it's lupus. Like, he was like, of course, it's very obvious, like, that you've got lupus.
Out of interest, was that man Black?
I don't know what his ethnicity is.
But he wasn't white.
Maybe I actually don't know. He's a bit brown, but I don't know where he's from.
Right.
I actually don't know where he's from. He's a little bit brown though, but he's a professor in lupus. So
she said he might have a tan or he might be one of us. I'm not
he
sure.
Could be spicy white. I actually don't know. And the thing is that it's hard to tell because of colonization, because his surname is Portuguese, but he could be from anywhere with a Portuguese surname. Mm-hmm. So I have no clue where that man's from. But he's my king. He diagnosed me. I stan him.
Lee, what Jam was talking about just then, about this idea of like going to the doctors and having those frustrations of not being taken seriously, there was even an example where she gave where the person's saying it's to do with mental health and she's coming to them with all these evidence and, you know, all this history of why it's definitely not a mental health or why it seems like it's not going to be a mental health issue. Have you ever experienced something like that with the healthcare?
I mean, I have countless stories of having my illness, and I've heard other Black women in our community talk about it as well. Endometriosis being a perfect example, right? I mean, when I went to the doctor for the first time around endometriosis, knowing that I had been bloated, something was wrong with my stomach, like I was in constant pain, really bad periods. They were like, oh, you're just getting a little bit fat. Do you want to have a tummy tuck? Like, that was the first doctor that I went to. And she was a woman and a Black woman, but she completely disregarded my pain. And I know women who have had fibroids the size of, like, a proper 9-month pregnant belly and been completely disregarded. Like, oh, it's a benign tumor, don't worry about it. And of course, we know the maternal mortality statistics that Black women are 3 to 5 times more likely to die than their white counterparts. So I think this obviously speaks to an institutional systemic issue. And Jamisha, I'm sure you've encountered that along the way throughout your journey, not just in the first instance, right?
Yeah, multiple times. And a similar situation to you. I'm still undiagnosed for a pelvic-based chronic pain that I have, which I likely believe is somewhere along the lines of endo or adenomyosis or something. I just, you know, you can feel it, but you know more than anybody else what that experience is like. Like, I had a laparoscopy before. It's like a keyhole surgery. So they use a little camera and they go in, and that's one of the ways that they diagnose endometriosis right. properly. And there was there's a whole story to it, but I won't go into it, but they saw a fibroid, and then the way they remarked on it was like, well, they didn't actually tell me. I saw the pictures because I made a complaint. I had to come in and I saw the picture of my uterus. And I was like, what's that round thing on it? Like, what's that? Oh, it's fibroid. I'm like, all right. So when were you going to tell me? Oh, that doesn't cause you pain. That's not causing you pain.
Which is okay. A complete lie. Like, that's definitely
also,
not true.
Even if it didn't cause you pain, yeah, because maybe it wasn't causing you pain. The point is, I still deserve to know what's going on in my body.
I'd like to know.
How dare you tell me? Like, you did the whole scan. You made me lay down.
You're showing me the picture. I'm looking at the picture. I'm thinking, yeah, what's that little... I can see there's something on it. Like, is that... But yeah, so it happens all the time. And I think it's interesting in what you said in terms of that a Black doctor did that. Because while I still often call it like there's a medical racism issue, it can still be perpetuated by doctors that look like you. And yeah. Sometimes worse, because they 100%. Kind of perpetuate that, oh, Black women has to be strong.
Oh, like, my gosh.
No, yeah. Not in healthcare.
Yeah, no, because this conversation, yeah, I didn't realize it would be triggering to me, but it is. Because I've had this issue with bloating for like 3 years, yeah? To the point where I could buy a dress on Monday, go to wear it on Friday, and a dress is not doing up. Like, that's how significant the bloating is with that I'm navigating. And I went to the doctors the other day and I'm like, oh, can I get a further test done for the bloating? Like, it's actually now starting to, I'm not going to lie, I was exaggerating a bit, but I was like, it's starting to impact my mental health.
You have to exaggerate.
I can't leave the house because I was like, unless I say it's a mental health issue, they're not going to take me seriously. And then they were like, oh, you've been tested before, your tests have been fine. And I'm like, no, we're not getting it. We need to do further tests, because if every time I'm getting tests, they're fine, there must be something else you're not testing for. Do you get what I mean? And I remember being told, like, this was years ago now, I got an internal scan done and they were like, oh, you've got cysts on your ovaries, yeah? So I was then frightened, like, oh, I've got polycystic ovary syndrome. Then the next time I went, they were like, you haven't got cysts on your ovaries. And I'm like, but I thought I had polycystic ovary syndrome. And they're like, no, but you met... And then the person I had on that occasion, like, explained it to me that I might have had... You can have cysts and not have the syndrome because there's other symptoms that you have to have to be diagnosed as the syndrome. But it's like, till this day, I'm like, but what if I do have it and you guys are just missing it? Because all the symptoms I have lead to someone who has PCOS. But it's like, they're not listening to me at all. And I feel like, you know, there's a lot of biases that happen. And the example you gave, Jam, was the one that I was about to talk about, which is about like this idea that you're being strong. So I feel like even the point I just made about having to like over-exaggerate how you're feeling, whenever I go to the hospital, and I hate hospitals, I have a really bad phobia, so I never really go unless it's like a really critical stage. And even then, I still feel like I have to over-amplify it to be taken seriously, because otherwise they'll just leave you in pain, just chilling at the in the A&E ward. And of course, not all doctors are like this, and not all nurses are like this. And we know in the NHS, like in the UK, they are really, really stretched. So sometimes I feel like you're in those situations and those predicaments, and it's not actually a fault of the doctors and nurses themselves, but it's just very, very frustrating to have to go through.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think it was on your page actually, where you were talking about, or there was a post about a famous doctor married to medicine. Was it Jackie Walters? Is that her name? Or Jackie? I don't remember. Dr. Jackie on Married to Medicine. I don't know if you watch Married to Medicine, Sham. But she was basically saying that Black women exaggerate their symptoms. And one, Shan's point just proves that sometimes you feel like you have to, otherwise you won't get heard. And also, I was really shocked to hear a Black woman, and allegedly someone who, you know, is a proponent and, you know, an advocate for the Black community and for Black mm-hmm. women in general on breast cancer and so many other illnesses, that she would have said something like that. I don't know mm-hmm. the additional context, but yeah, it always surprises me when it comes from a Black doctor.
I mean, for me, it didn't. And that's because when I talk about like these issues, this medical racism, it's because it's like it's a system. So even the Black doctors are not immune to perpetuating it. You know, some of these untruths are in the textbooks. They're in the way that many doctors are trained. So it's why I'm often like, it's not an individual doctor type issue, although a lot of them can be rude, or some are nice, some are not. But there's a systemic problem which continues to like perpetuate some of these untruths, because it's wild that she said that, especially as someone that is looking after pregnant people specifically. And then I'm not going to repeat the exact stories, but there were people that came out afterwards that have had her as a doctor that spoke about their experiences. I won't repeat them because I don't want to get this podcast in trouble. But you know, it was interesting because it shows that ideology can be linked to the outcome of the patient. And so it might seem like, oh, they she just said this flippant comment, but it had a real world impact on people. But yeah, like one of the pieces I had to research, I was trying to dig into like where some of these ideas come from, because there's like this overall idea of Black people having a higher pain tolerance and thicker skin. And it's even in the stats, you know, you're less likely statistically to get prescribed pain medication like opiates, for example, because they just don't perceive your pain as the same. And there was a study that was done that basically did find that many of the white doctors they surveyed did hold some kind of bias or untruth about a Black body. They did have this idea that Black people have a higher pain tolerance. And when asked, where did you get that? They were like, oh, and some of them were like, I learned that in school. And some of that call comes from slavery, because that's what the doctors on the plantations used to say. And I saw that in the US and I thought, did that happen in, you know, the UK? Let me have a look. And I did find some old papers that were written in the 1700s and a few plantation doctors that would have worked in St. Kitts, Jamaica, they would write their findings on working on the plantations. And one of them particularly would say that the Negro's tolerance for pain is like really high, and that, you know, I've amputated the leg of many a Negro and many would hold their own legs up while I was doing the amputation, or that like the Negro woman has a doesn't have the same gentle disposition as a white woman or something like that, right? And these are written into books that inform a lot of what we know about medicine today. You know, some of the actual tech that you use in medical settings came from doctors that were literally on plantations. So it doesn't surprise me, because no one's really unchecked it. Like, no one's really reflected on it properly. So this continues to get passed down. But to the point about, like, I guess sometimes the Black doctors doing it, I just sometimes have to remind myself, I need to be soft and like really gentle and really like worthy of gentleness. Otherwise, I don't want to fall into that idea and then, you know, something gets missed because I didn't really advocate for myself pain-wise, even if it is a Black doctor telling me, oh, like, I mean, sorry to go on, but like the other day I wanted my IUD changed and I said, I'm getting local anesthetic, period. Because I just struggle with pain. So I said, I'm not going in without that, because I Googled it and you can ask. And it was a Black doctor on the phone that said, well, usually when women come in, they just take paracetamol and ibuprofen beforehand and it's fine. I said, I'm not most women, so run me the local anesthetic, please. Thank you. And then she's like, okay, I'm going to have to. But immediately it was a, well, usually, I'm not usually. So I'm asking for what I want. I'm not accepting it anymore because I'm just tired of it. So I'm worthy of gentleness and softness in the medical setting.
See, anytime I can ask for anesthetic, I'm down for it. Like getting my teeth taken out. Give me some local anesthetic.
Yes. Yeah, I think we deserve that. And even when it's doctors that look like us, we have to sometimes tell them, you know, that's not good for us, right? Like, don't do that, you know? Maybe that will change something. Maybe that will, I don't know.
I have a strong dislike, like many people, for needles. And as someone who's anemic, I have to frequently get blood tests. And I went to the hospital, and they went to give me a blood test. And I explained to the lady, it was a Black lady, I explained to her, I'm not very good with needles, but if I just put my arm out and turn my head and you do it, I'm not going to react. But if you like take the needle out slowly, you're walking around and talking to people and waving this needle around, my anxiety is going to kick in. I'm going to have a panic attack. The lady was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, okay. So I'm watching this lady and I'm literally, I put my head in my hood because I'm like, I'm bugging out. Like, I can feel my hands getting sweaty. I can feel myself like going to have a panic attack. So she comes over and I'm like, oh, I don't think now's a good time because I'm going to have a panic attack. Yeah. And she was like, let me not do the accent. But basically what she was saying was, is that like, why are you going to have a panic attack over the needle? Like, you're a big girl. Like, and she said a comment, like, I don't have any lollipops to give you. I've given them to all the children today. And I was just like, this isn't about lollipops or fear. Like, I'm sitting here because I'm going to get it done. But what I'm saying to you is, me seeing the needle is going to trigger me to have a panic attack. And then in the end, the lady came to do it and I reacted, yeah. And like, went to like push her away. Oh my gosh, she called security. She called what? Security, yeah. What? She called security. She was like, oh, this woman's pushed me. She's delaying time. We've got a very busy A&E ward and she's made me be waiting like 20 minutes. Like, I just broke down and was just crying. And because there was other women in the like era that I was in, there was like a woman that was there with her daughter, who was probably a similar age to me. That woman advocated for me, and that was a white lady. And she basically stood up for me to say, like, she came, she explained how she felt. This lady was walking around with the needle, the exact same thing she told her not to do. And then she started having a panic attack. So when she came over, her natural reaction was to push back. It wasn't that I was pushing the lady to, like, show force. And it's only when I'm listening to you speak now that I've even remembered that experience, because I think I was so, like, traumatised from everything that was going on that I just really just compartmentalised it. And in the end, like, another lady done it and it was fine. But it's just, like, I wasn't saying I understand, but I don't. It's, like... Maybe more kids have issues with needles than adults. That's a fair point. But if I've come to you calmly and I'm telling you this is an issue, you can't tell me how my body's going to respond to something. But I wanted to go thank you. I wanted to go back to your, where you were talking about of your story, where you had this king.
Yeah.
We had this no-name king, no-race king. He doesn't see race. We had this king. No-name. Nah, I'm joking.
What a way to describe my professor, doctor.
Sorry.
No, not you, not me.
We had a king professor, yeah, PhD. We had him, love him. And he helped you on your journey of getting a diagnosis. So talk to me about what your experience was like when you then found out you had lupus. Like, what was your initial thoughts and feelings like? And what were some of the, major changes you had to make in your life?
Well, yeah, firstly, the way he said it was so anticlimactic as well. You know, sometimes you expect this big moment, like, I need to tell you something. No, it was just, yeah, you have lupus, yeah. So it was a bit like, oh. And I was really happy. Like, obviously, a lot of people don't get that. A lot of non-disabled or non-sick people don't understand. But if you've gone through a period of not knowing what you've got, or not knowing why your body's doing something, and then finally now you've been told, it was a relief. Because I forgot to mention, even at one point, you know, I was going to Royal Marsden to see if it was cancer. I didn't know, you know, and that's probably where I was like, oh, this could be cancer. Oh my God. Like, so knowing that lupus is still a serious illness. I just think, you know, the big C is also just quite intimidating, and even in the collective consciousness. So I was a bit scared, but knowing it was lupus and I'm reading up about it and knowing that people live, you know, if you manage it well, can live long lives, it just made me feel a lot better. And in a way, the mistake I made was, I was just like, right, medication, back on track. I'm going to be back how I was before. Because no one tells you that you might not go back to how you were before. And I haven't been back to what I'm like before. So that was my mistake, is I was trying to go back to my life, my normal life, and I didn't realize that I had to learn to live a new life. And that was the harder part mentally, because I had just started uni, film school, which is very physical, right? They expect you to be on set standing for long hours in the day, which is not good for non-disabled, non-sick people. That's tiring anyway. For me, who could barely get out of bed, you know, sleeping still 16 hours, it was almost impossible, which then was like, okay, so then how am I going to do film then? I might have to quit because I can't do what these lot are doing. So why am I spending my money to going on this course? So it was a lot of like having to retrain and reframe how I saw things, how I'm going to do things, what might work for me. And that's difficult because I wasn't expecting that. And that's the part that, you know, when you get diagnosed, no one tells you. You got to figure that out on your own. And allowing myself to actually have help, because I will like go on the train and I'm not going to sit on a priority seat because that's not for me. That's for older ladies and people that have like physical disabilities that I can see, it's not for me, and not realizing I can sit there, I can take the lift, I can do these things. And yes, people might make comments, which they used to, like, I get it less now, but people would be like, why are you getting the lift? You got legs, you got young legs, stuff like that. I have to ignore it, because I'm like, I know what's going to happen to me after if I don't look after myself. So really had to completely overhaul what it meant to be kind to myself, to live, and not like have this idea of hustle and I gotta just be disciplined. I could be disciplined, I'm still gonna be sick. So I had to just sort of completely rethink about how I wanted to live life.
And what does that rethinking look like? Like, how does I guess, especially in the context of work, you mentioned having to be on set, like, how do you get through or navigate that, knowing that there are still, you know, shoot days and other things that require physical energy where you may not have it?
The initial way I dealt with it was I just slightly adapted. So I was like, okay, I'm going to edit because I can sit. I can still be in film. I can sit and edit. I didn't realize I didn't really like editing, to be honest with you. Like, I was just like, this is actually kind of boring. I don't really like it. So it made me realize that if I want to do stuff, I have to be the boss. That's a sad reality, because most workplaces are not suitable or not as accommodating as they could be for disability or illness, especially illness that fluctuates, where sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's not. So in the back of my mind, even though I had no money at the time, at some point I was like, whatever it is, I need to work towards working for myself, because I can then set my schedule, I can set the things. Even if it's not now, at some point it needs to be that. So that was part of it. The other part was just knowing the body is not designed to be beaten into submission all the time. It's not designed to just be like, hustling is not going to cure the lupus. It's not going to, like, if I just fix my mindset, because a lot of people say that, you know, you go in with the positivity. Yeah, you can still do that, but I have to actually rest when I can, and I have to communicate that. It's not easy. I've been fired from job because of that. Like, you know, actually being like, I cannot come to work. I can't. It's hard to communicate it with a new job. You know, you're kind of like to your manager, but I have to, because otherwise what's the other option? Suffer in silence
been your experience with like communicating that to a manager? Because I think even for yourself, you know, we mentioned a moment ago that as Black women, there's a stereotype that we are strong. And I think I can only talk for myself when I say this. For a long time, I had adopted that trait as part of my personality. And this is very different. Like, I'm going to say this is very different, but I have social anxiety, and there's a post that we have on our TikTok, which is about being in the workplace and having social anxiety and tips with that. And one of the suggestions that I gave was actually being transparent with your boss about the fact that you have it. But in as much as I've said that, I've recently changed jobs and I haven't been transparent with my boss about the fact that I have it, because actually me doing that feels like I'm now made to feel like I'm inadequate to do my job, or it makes me feel like I'm weak, or I don't want to be looked at like, oh, like I want grace, but I don't want to be babied, you know, like I can do it. I just want you to know that I might have challenges at time because of this thing. So I wonder like how much you may resonate with that process of having to tell a supervisor or a manager about your condition.
I resonate with it a lot. It's actually a question that comes up a lot in terms of just the disabled community in general. Work is one of the harder things. And I always say as well, I don't have a straight answer, because I can sit here and say what I would like, which is go to your manager, communicate. The reality is that not everyone is in a position to be able to do that. There's a reason why some people hide it, you know, and so it differs based on person to person. However, the modes that the headspace I've got into is I usually communicate quite early on, not when I'm applying for the job, usually when I get the job. I don't tell them at the application stage, so that there's no doubt that I didn't get rejected for being disabled, because you can't prove it. It's hard to tell. But I will be like, okay, I have this disability, and I tell them how I need to work. I have to communicate with them about how this is going to work between the two of us. So it's more like action based. So I will say, hi, I've got chronic illness called lupus. And then I'll explain that this is what it does. On some occasions, I would need this in place. And so it's more like constructive. Fortunately, obviously my previous job, or previous three jobs, were all at the same place, at BBC. They're decent, pretty good. It depends on the team. Like, my last team was great. The first team wasn't the best, but it wasn't the worst. Mm-hmm. And it just depends on what type of person you have and how they view it. But then that then leads to the next stage of, even when something falls, it's not always sometimes a one-time conversation. You sometimes have to have this conversation multiple times to remind people, hello, do you remember when I said this? yeah, this is something, sorry. Like, don't message me at 3 a.m., please, to edit something. I really need to sleep more than the average person, actually. Or with my last job with BBC, I would say, I need to work from home today. I mean, that was easier in the pandemic, but even before the pandemic, like lockdown, Fridays, I was like, it's my work from home day. And I also would say that there are certain days where I can work, but the traveling to work, like I might have joint pain, is going to make this really difficult. Yeah. Please, can I do it from home? So having that flexibility, it was knowing that it's a constant conversation that needs to come up whenever there's like a something, you know, it's not knowing, it's not like a one and done. It often is like a, I can't think of the word, but it's often that throughout the employment that that conversation needs to be had. Yeah. But I do it. And then lastly, also, when I'm actually sick, I always say this, is if you can afford to, take one extra day after you feel better.
Right.
Because how many times have you gone back and you're like, I'm all right now. And then you actually go and you're like, oh, one more day.
Yeah.
Take one day after.
We did a podcast the other day about being black and in the workplace. And obviously myself and Leanne aren't disabled. So we actually probably didn't even touch on that element of like tips that we could give to maybe an employer that might have been listening. But if you was to have like three main considerations that an employer could take on board if they have someone in their team, or they may eventually have someone in their team who is disabled, what would that be based on your experience?
I'd say be prepared to have more than one conversation. You know, disability is not just a one and done set of framework. And then that's it. I think secondly is also know that there's different types of disabilities, because I do think that a lot of employers have a rigid view of disability that doesn't include neurodiversity. It doesn't include like chronic illness. It doesn't include stuff like that. They often, I feel like a lot of the framework they have when they think of, oh, I've got a disabled employee is like a wheelchair user. And they think, oh, I've got a ramp, I've got a lift. Yeah. And accessibility is actually something that is really vast. It depends on whoever you're dealing with, and so it's ensuring that like you know that. And I think third is like creating the safe space for the conversation, but allowing the disabled person to feel empowered to lead on how their access should be. Don't be like oh yeah, like, you know, allow, you know, some disabled people might come into the workplace and they don't even want to talk about it like that. I usually recommend it, but some people just want to one time, that's it, I'm going to get on with it. That's how it, if that's how they want to do it, you have to go by, I think, their lead, because you don't want to like feel like you're just like trying to be a parent to disabled people and it's patronizing and condescending. So
and I'm interested because we talk about it in the workplace and we've talked about it within the medical system. I mean, I'm sure amongst your friends and family, it's also an issue that you need to talk about, especially for some of those lesser well-known conditions like you've mentioned, like lupus and, you know, being neurodiverse. And it's very quick. I feel like in our community, it's very quick to dismiss this as the person being lazy or crazy or whatless or whatever it is. And so to to come at it from all angles, like, I can only imagine that that must have an impact on your mental health, like consistently having to question yourself or have other people question you, say, oh, you're not really sick, or like, I guess if you could talk a little bit about what that's like.
Well, fortunately, I think where I'm at now, I'm a lot better, but like in terms of how I've been taking it on mentally, but in the early stages, it was very difficult because you have a lot of well-meaning people that can sometimes make you feel really bad about what you're going through. And it took time to advocate for myself within my family and to communicate clear boundaries about how I wanted to discuss my disability. Firstly, that disabled is not a dirty word. I have no shame in saying I'm disabled. Not everybody wants to say that term and that's their choice. But like, I would say that and people would be like, why are you labeling yourself? Why, you know, you don't want all these other people to restrict you. I was like, I understand where you're coming from, because that is historically how disabled people have been treated. Me personally, though, I'm going to be saying it because that's what it is. And it helps me actually get what I need. That's number one. Number two, it's a lot of, why don't you just open the curtains and let the sun come in? Okay, cool. Or my lovely grandma, my lovely Bayesian grandma would be, take your tonic. And I'm like... okay. And I will take it because I love my grandma, so I'll just be like, but granny, like, the tonic's not going to cure my lupus. Yes, but the tonic. And I'm like, okay, yeah, yeah, fair enough.
Holistic health is really big with us, yeah? And, you know, when it comes to me right now, I'm feeling a bit low. I'm definitely going to be going to get my ginger in a minute, boiling it out of my turmeric and my cayenne pepper. And I know, factually, I'm going to be feeling better in a few days just by taking that. I don't need the antibiotics. However, I think there's a...
there's a joke.
There's a line that Caribbean grandmas don't always want to cross. It's like, the celery juice is not going to fix my joints today, okay? Your little... Whatever you're telling me is not going to help me today. Like, maybe over time these things will help. And I'm not like dissing or like putting down holistic health. I think it's important. I think there's a place for it. But I think that sometimes, I imagine it could be quite frustrating when you've just got this diagnosis. You're trying to figure out how to navigate it for yourself. And someone's telling you, just open the window. It's like, well, if I thought it was that easy, I wouldn't have gone through all these different hospitals to get here.
Yeah. And you know it comes from a good place. Mm-hmm. This is the thing. Like, a lot of the times it does. But yeah, and just to say as well, I think my life is a marriage between those holistic things, because I will never cast down those remedies. I like taking some of them. The fact that one of them is just a shot of rum, I'm not going to say no to that. Come on. We've got medicine. I'm like, yeah, I'll put it on my chest and, you know, like, put it on my forehead and that, like, I'm not going to say no to that. But yeah, like, it's a marriage between those two things. But I think I just kept my resolve, I guess. Like, it was hard in some instances, but me actually keeping that sort of boundary, and then whenever, like, it would come up, stopping people in their tracks and being like, no, I have lupus. Mm-hmm. No, I have lupus. It's an autoimmune disease. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll try that. I'll try that and see how it goes. But, you know, that has helped, because in a way people have changed now. Maybe it's just to me, maybe they still hold those beliefs, but they don't come with the same energy that they used to anymore, because I think it took a while of me just maybe training them to just kind of like, yeah. And even when talking about other people, you know, being like, well, because if I'm going to be honest, in my experience, in my personal, like, family experience, the chronic illness part was tricky, and there was some people that, like, just didn't get it or thought I was lazy. But probably what was harder to communicate, which I do more of these days, is that mental health and neurodiversity, that is not, it's just not given the respect it gets. And so I try to intervene. Like, if a conversation comes up and someone, you can tell they might be having a mental health episode, or it's an autistic person or whatever, I intervene every single time, because it's just like, we need to kind of like level up now from these conversations. Mm. And not, for example, say that someone's autistic because they were born with forceps.
Yeah.
You know, like, just, it's not needed. Like, and also to have a bit more grace. And so, you know, you can't just beat autism out of children, and you can't, like, you know, do all of that. So it's trying to be like, no, we're not going to do that. They're having a meltdown. They need a minute. That's it. Like, so it's just, I just nip things in the bud now.
Yeah.
Just, you know.
And I mean, I guess knowing that there are so many people that are dealing with these kind of hidden illnesses and wanting to advocate for yourself, how did that transition into your platform?
Well, I never, like, initially intended to make, like, the platform like that. It came just through a few chance events, I guess, like, if that makes sense. So I've always, when I had the lupus, like, I was like, okay, I do want to talk about it more, definitely. Because I also was like, you know, at uni, I was talking to people, and then all these things would come up. You know, one person had MS, one person had something else. I found a guy that had Crohn's. So a lot of people were just walking around with these things, and I had no idea. And it was very common. Like, as soon as I bring up lupus, they go, oh yeah, I've got, or my mum's got. So I was like, okay, so there's something that, like, is not, it's not that rare. Like, there's like a lot of people are dealing with stuff. So I knew there was something that I wanted to do. But then at the time, my uni had this weird competition where they wanted us to collaborate with the other courses more. So they created this little award thing called the Connect Awards. And they were giving away 1,000 of grant funding just to get it started if you collaborated with someone of a different course. So then, yeah, I met up with this guy, and I was like, I want to do an animated series about chronic illness and have all these stories that other people were sharing with me and put it in, like, a series. And he was an animator, so we teamed up, pitched it. The name You Look Okay To Me came because it was one day before the deadline and I needed to come up with something. And I was like, okay, let me write that down. And then when we did the pitch, they were like, wonderful name, where did you get it? So it took me a very long time to think about it. It just came in a dream, like, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, I did not just, like, scribble it down on the paper. But the series didn't really work out But then I kind of still felt like there was something there. And so I had a mentor that was in marketing, and he was kind of like, you just need to kind of perceive it as a movement in a way. And then I then had another mentor that was like, the reason why also it's not growing is because you have the story in yourself and you're not sharing it. Yeah. How can you expect people to share stories with you and you post it and you're not willing to be vulnerable yourself? And so I just started like posting, and then that's sort of where it sort of started to grow. Mm-hmm. And other people were connecting, and then yeah, right, it just now. Grew from there. So it's all little things that sort of just like led to wherever we are now. It's life. Life is like that though, isn't it?
And from having the page, has there been any consistent themes that have come out that you've maybe seen in the comments and want people that they keep, you know, saying about any particular topic?
The work one comes up all the time. Mm-hmm. Medical gaslighting comes up all the time. You know, like the long diagnosis process, doctors having this mentality of top down telling you and not listening to you and not collaborating with you, that comes up a lot. And it doesn't matter what country it is. This is the thing, like it could be, you know, there's people from all over the world that connect with me now. And so it'll be people from the Middle East or people from Asia, and all the story, even if it might have nuances based on like the country they're in and the culture, it tends to be that there's this understanding of like just not being listened to in general. That's sort of like a main thing. And then outward behaviors of illness from just general public of just not understanding. Those are like things that are like the general things that no matter what your ethnicity is, those are things that like everyone tends to relate to. And then of course you'll have some specifics that are specific to your gender or your ethnicity, your religion, your country even, you know, those are the more tiny ones that are like specific.
And is there anything that's come out that's like surprised you or shocked you?
The thing I'd say that maybe surprised me or shocked me was a specific one. This is slightly connected to your Looker case, but not really, but this was when I was doing a story about sickle cell. And I was supposed to do a sickle cell story in general, and then I actually made it specific to the Nigerian community or West African community, because I found out that it was stigmatized like heavily. Whereas for me, I don't know, I can't speak for all Caribbean people, but I didn't see it so stigmatized in the Caribbean. Mm. I knew people knew about it and were like, oh, he's sick. Oh, and it was taken very seriously, but I never saw it as can't marry you, being shunned, you're demonic. That is one of the first times I was like, I've not experienced that before. Mm. And yeah, it's specific to a lot of, I basically know I've met 3 people that didn't know they had sickle cell until they were in their teens because their parents hid it from them.
Really? What, as in like,
yeah,
fully had it or just they had the trait?
Fully had sickle cell.
Wow.
Their parents knew the whole time, as in they'd stopped them from swimming. They stopped them from going outside in the cold. So they remember stories of, my mum told me I couldn't do these things, and I didn't know why. One of the girls in particular is my friend. She said she went to school and a Jamaican girl was like, you got sickle cell, I have sickle cell, because your eyes are like yellow and like we have these things. And then she asked her mum. Mum's like, yeah, yeah. And she said, why didn't you tell me? Oh, it's that, because she didn't want us to shame.
Right.
So I think sometimes when I learn some specifics like that, those are the things that shock me. Because I think most other things, they don't. But like sometimes like a certain ethnicity will tell me a story and I'm like, oh my gosh, like what a way to experience illness and pain.
In a weird way, not to like give compassion to those parents, but I think when you were telling that story, it made me think about the idea of being a mum and having a baby and that kind of pressure that comes with having this perfect baby, this righteous baby, this baby that's, you know, do you know what I mean? There's a lot of taboos and stigma around children and like how your child comes out. Do you know what I mean? Especially when it comes to like being disabled or having conditions. I think sometimes, yeah, I've heard conversations of parents blaming it on them. Like, what did I do that made my child have this and that? Yeah. So I guess that's a whole like another conversation, another topic. But I thought it was interesting just then that you mentioned the idea of marriage. And I wanted to ask, like, we've spoken about how you being diagnosed kind of impacted your relationship with your family in terms of certain conversations that you had. But like, what's it been like in terms of relationships, both romantic and platonic?
So in terms of romantic relationships, I've mainly been okay. That's what's quite surprising. I think any issue that I've had with that has been internalized. It's not that anything anyone else has done, is sometimes feelings of inadequacy, because, you know, like you might look at what other couples are doing and what able to do, and then you're thinking, well, maybe like that person that you're with might want to do that and now they can't because of me, or I don't want them to feel like they have to be my carer because they didn't sign up for that, blah, blah, blah. But those have never come from someone else saying that. It's more so myself. And that's where you're measuring yourself up to other people. And that's a lot of self-work that I would have to do. And also partly, oftentimes people want to look after you. Like they want to. Like, you know, you might be like, oh, I don't want to be a burden. But, you know, love, as we spoke about at the beginning, can be expressed in different ways. It's about safety. It's about like making someone feel cared for, and care can be manifested in different ways. I often care for people. I often assume I don't because I'm not physically always doing it, but we care for each other in all these different ways. So after a while, I had to kind of be like, let people have the choice as well and give people agency to care for you and love you in these ways. And you know, if they have a problem, ask them. If they don't, stop worrying about it. So that's in terms of a romantic sense. And it's similar with friends. A lot of my friends have just inadvertently just do things now without me being asked to make sure I'm okay. It's just become like that after the years of having this illness. So, you know, I still go clubbing sometimes, but my friends will be like checking if the club has seating, because not every club does, but they're like, does the club have a little bench? They sometimes will ask the bouncers, can I have a chair so she can sit down? And it's embarrassing because everyone's raving and I'm just like or in the chair, like,
but there's no two-step. It's the finger pump now.
And my friends will be like, "You're gonna sit in that chair because you need." And they can tell. They're like, "I can see you need to sit down."
But that's so important.
So there's this. It's beautiful, actually, and I think so sometimes having that shows what love can be like in so different, and how it can be expressed in so many different ways. And so it is nice. And I haven't had issues with friends with my disability, I can't lie.
Mm-hmm. I think that connects back to the question that Shan started at the beginning about love and safety, and you actually saying that love is an action and it's something that people show you. And just the fact that you have these friends and family members and loved ones that are doing this for you without you even having to ask, and alleviating you of that burden to have to ask is a beautiful thing. When you meet people for the first time, or when you go out on a blind date or something like that, is there a right time? Like, because I know you mentioned like not necessarily you know, wanting to openly talk about it or share it immediately. There's that feeling of like hesitation because you don't want to burden people. So what's the timing for you to say, actually, this is something that I want to share?
It's a good question. I haven't had to like share it in terms of romantically because I'm in a relationship. However, when I was dating prior to that, I kind of had to bring it up on the first date because it's literally my job. So I think that was the only thing that I couldn't get around, because then they go, what do you do? Or they go, oh, can I follow you on Instagram? And then you go, okay, well, the Instagram... is like, there's no, I can't, and they're going to be like, okay, like, so it's just
okay to me, are you okay?
I really, if I was thinking ahead back then, I would have gave them the Finsta, like the private one, and then maybe it would have given me more time, but I wasn't thinking at the time. I usually have brought it up almost immediately because it's a big part of what I do on the day to day. But I think if it were any other instance, I'd probably like, I don't know, maybe wait one extra time, but I just don't, maybe it's because it's been so long, I just don't carry any issue with just saying it, to be honest. I don't tell everyone all my business, but if it comes up naturally in conversation, I'm just like, oh yeah, I have lupus, like, you know, and then if you want to talk about it deeper, we can, but for me, it doesn't feel so big of a thing anymore. Yeah. Obviously, everyone's different. I just think you do it when it feels right.
And I guess in a dating sense as well, it probably helps to get rid of the people that shouldn't benefit from who you are anyway.
Exactly, yeah. So I think it's also a good marker as to if someone is for you or not because of that.
And just to wrap, I'd be interested to know, because I was thinking of this earlier, if you were to go back to Jamisha in Brit, who was going through the frustrations and the process of trying to get diagnosed and not being heard, what words do you think she would have benefited from hearing?
It sounds so cliche because a lot of people say this, but it would be this: it's not in your head. Because it's and everyone says it now. It's like, oh, it's not all in your head, but it really. I think I really needed to hear that back then. It is not in your head because I really was doubting my reality. That's what gaslighting does, isn't it? You know, it makes you not know what's real, and for a big chunk of time in that wait period between seeing our racially ambiguous professor, it was like a few months. And so in that time, I was just like, I don't know if I can trust what my body is telling me. Mm-hmm. It is hurting. It hurts. And imagining a reality in which that is not real. And then part of it is like, am I exaggerating? Like, I don't know. All of that, that just caused unnecessary anxiety for a very long time. And if I'm going to be honest, even still to this day, it's almost 10 years. If it'll be in September, it'll be 10 years since I got diagnosed. Even to this day, whenever I'm getting my blood test, I'm like, what if it's not lupus though? After all these times, it's just something that stains the brain. So even when I go to the lupus clinic, I'm like, maybe I don't have it. Maybe they're going to snatch the diagnosis away from me and I'm going to go back to not knowing what's going on. Mm. Still. So I would tell myself back then and even now that it is not in your head. It's real.
That's really good advice, particularly given people who might, you know, might be on the verge of being diagnosed or thinking that something is wrong, but somebody like in your situation was telling them that they have mental health issues or that they're depressed or anything else. And I'm sure you talk about this on the page and on the platform and provide many other tips and pieces of advice. So if you could share the platform, but also just give a little summary of what it's about and where people can find you.
So you can find me on You Look Okay to Me, mainly on Instagram. And yeah, it's just, we talk about chronic illness, but specifically disability and chronic illness and how that intersects with every part of life, every part of your identity. And I tend to have a nice specific focus as well on further marginalizations as well. So making sure that there's better representation of Black, disabled and sick people, people of color, which are sometimes left out of the conversations in conversations about disability. You know, when you often see it on TV, you don't often see some melanin. So I speak about everyone, but you'll definitely find some disabled colour on the page as well. So if you want to look for that, then come to the Instagram. And we talk about mental health too as well. I just wanted to also just follow up. Like, obviously, when I was mentioning that they were like, oh, you have depression. I do have depression as well. And I want to make sure that I'm clear that it's not something that I see as lesser. And so I also speak about mental health on the page, but in a way that doesn't par off one on the other, that they're all important to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But definitely not interchangeable. And one that should be mistaken for the other.
Yeah, not a way to diminish either on either side. Yes, exactly.
Definitely. Thanks so much for joining. I feel like I've learned a lot just in this short period of time of this hour of like the additional things to consider when we were talking about like the Black woman at work conversation, as Shan said earlier, and just like how to better navigate talking to people about their chronic illnesses as well. Like, I think everybody has learned quite a bit. So thanks for sharing with us. Thanks for joining. And definitely everyone check out You Look Okay to Me. Thank you so much for listening to the Unapologetically Black podcast brought to you by the Dope Black Women CIC.
If you like this episode, please tweet us, DM us, or even message us at Dope Black Women across all socials.
Unapologetically Black.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.